Welcome back, everyone, to an episode of The Money Seat, the show where my guests ask me five questions, finance or money related. The catch is they have not sent me these questions beforehand, so I haven't had any time to prepare. And I will also be airing the fully unedited version of our interview, so there's no editing or cutting to make me look smarter than I am. So it'll be hopefully more entertaining, and I'm excited to see where this is going to go. My next guest today is Sophia. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Sophia.
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Sophia. I live and work in Chicago, and I work as a digital marketer. In the past year, outside of this whole pandemic thing, I got engaged and moved into a house. So
very exciting.
I guess some good news, some good things happen. Otherwise, I spend my time watching too many Netflix shows, playing with my dog, learning to embroider, generally just sitting inside. My main money strategy, since this is a show about money, putting it out there, it's kind of a mix of aggressive saving and like periods of panic. That's how I'll describe it.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds familiar. Great. So yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you and hopefully feeling less panic after some of my questions. Or maybe we can share the panic.
That's what I'm hoping for. I had a question for you. So you said congrats on the engagement and moving in with your fiance. How old are you again?
Oh, how dare you. I'm 29. I'm turning 30 this year.
Oh, congrats. And what school did you go to?
I went to U of I. And actually, I'm wearing a U of I sweater, which obviously people on the podcast can hear, but maybe it's like
audio only. Enough. Yeah, audio only. Illinois. And what did you major in at Illinois?
So I majored actually in English.
Okay. You'd be surprised because I asked that to everyone. And most of the time, it's like 50-50 if their major aligns to what they're doing in their career. And I just think that that's kind of interesting. I had a guy who did like philosophy and now he's a restaurant manager. So, you know, it's just like, it's just funny how that works. Well, thank you. So I'm sure you're very excited to put me on that hot seat and get those questions asked. You're someone who likes to grill me, you know, outside of this. So I'm curious and excited to see what you have in store. So, let's get started with question number one, Sophia.
All right. So just before I started the questions, I started them with more general, and then toward the end, they're going to be more specific to my life.
Cool.
So that's just a forewarning to you.
All right.
And I have an extra one just in case, like, you heard one of these before.
Okay.
Move on. It's fine. All right. Question number one, and this is going to sound like a lot of questions, but it's just one question with like a lot of sub thoughts.
Okay.
So what determines the value of currency? Like, what is money?
Whew.
Why is a dollar more expensive than a peso? Why are the rates of some currencies, why do they fluctuate so much? Like, what's up with that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and definitely a little bit out of my expertise and comfort zone, which is great because I'm going to tackle it anyways. So what gives currency value, I think, is the perfect thing to answer first, right? Because like you hand someone, we don't use, you know, cash as much anymore, but let's say we used to, and you give someone a $20 bill. Well, what gives that value to purchase your goods and services in life? And what would be interesting to know is that it's actually used to be backed by the Federal Reserve, who had gold and silver deposits. Mm-hmm. So the money on it, and sometimes you can see it, really old money could say like a Federal Reserve note or like a silver certificate, which actually means you can go there and give them that paper money and they would give you the equivalent in gold or silver.
Like, so you can still do that?
I don't know. I don't think so, because that would be crazy. People would hoard and then show up and buy all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that's how the U.S. started, because they needed to give validity to the cash, right?
Yeah.
And so now, I mean, I actually have one upstairs. It says silver certificate, and I keep it because I think it's kind of cool. But they don't make anything new like this. So right now, once you hit a certain point, you just know that the money is worth something based on the value of the U.S. economy is where more it's built off of now than like our gold and silver deposits. But that's how you get it started as well. For instance, like change is a different story. You know, like a penny has, you know, little things of copper in it that's supposed to be worth, you know, a cent of copper. And like nickel has like some nickels have like actual like nickel in it that if you melted it down, it would be worth more than the 5 cents that it's worth. So some of those things, you know, there are silver dollars that had a silver, was worth a dollar's worth of silver in it at the time it was made. And there were, you know, all that stuff like that. Now it's just, you put your faith in the country. I couldn't speak on, you know, Europe or Asia or how else they do it. But now it's all based on the economy and market. So if the U.S. government went under and there was a coup and there was a new government that took over, then your currency might be worthless. So
what does it mean that like the value of the economy, how do you value an economy?
So that I'll consider that question 1B.
No. Okay,
question 1B. Yeah. Don't worry. Everyone's been doing this. So that's a good question. So part of it is like the goods and services produced in your country, your exports, and also the value of the market. So the stock market, right? That's part of the value of, you know, people work, they earn wages, they contribute to the economy. We produce goods and services in our country and we export it out to other countries. Now, we don't do as much as we used to, right? We used to make a lot more stuff and produce goods and now we don't. But that's what that means. It's what we're producing. What's our value? What's our currency worth? What's our stock market worth? And that fluctuates as things go up and down. The euro and the pound fluctuate with the value compared to the US dollar, mostly based on how their economies are working. And right now the US economy is very strong. So it's a little stronger to the dollar or the euro than it used to be. But it's not like, there's not an exact science behind it. A lot of it is hope and optimism and trust of the people that we have the banks, we have the money, we have all these cash and everything there to be a sustainable country. But that's a very in-depth question that doesn't have a simple answer. So I kind of gave you a glossy overtone to the best of my econ knowledge.
So does it relate to like employment rate?
Not so much. I would say if you had very high unemployment in a country, then they probably would have a weaker currency, but it's not that correlated. I would say that has a very minor correlation in terms of employment. A lot of it does have to do with cash in terms of the interest rates, in terms of the bank, in terms of what they're lending and stuff like that. So it's very, and that's why it's always changing, because the economy and the banks and everything are always stronger, weaker over time, which means your dollar is going to be stronger, weaker over time compared to the rest of the world. But there's no like global currency, right? Which would solve a lot of our issues.
Is that what Bitcoin is?
Yeah. Well, interesting. Yes. Is that one of your? Do you want me to consider that 1C? Yeah, hey, sorry, we got disconnected. Yeah, no, we're good. So Bitcoin is that it's a future global currency. Absolutely. And there's a lot of other digital cryptocurrencies out there with the thought that whether it's Bitcoin or something else, that might be the future of where we're going to, because we're global. And the idea of having a currency for each country makes less sense when we're doing business all over the world all the time. But right now it's still on its way, right? We're still not there yet to having like an earth dollar, right? The thought is in 50 or 100 years, right, we have an earth dollar. but with so much different countries and their economies being so different, it's still hard to keep everything the same.
Yeah. That would be cool.
Yeah. I mean, there's some advantages too. So, right, the you know, China has a, and Japan have a, you know, what much weaker currency to the US. And it means that you can go and buy things from there and it's cheaper. So it gives them an advantage. People want to buy their goods over other places because it's cheaper there. So sometimes you actually have an advantage of having a cheaper currency, actually, especially if people come, right? You go to China and you could buy a lot more, or you could go to some places in Europe that have, you know, and then you go to Britain and everything's insanely expensive because the pound is...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so it also, you know, sometimes they can manipulate that as well to keep their currencies where they want, so they get tourism as well. Also a whole other topic of conversation.
Yeah, that sounds like a positive for if you're going into a country that has a weaker currency.
Yeah,
if you live in the country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was in China in 2010, and it was like 7 Chinese yuan, I think is called, to 1 American dollar. And everything was just really cheap. So it made going there great. It means you felt like you could spend more. So it just, they would get an influx of cash from other places, which is good for their economy, right? So that's exactly right. Other countries do that as well. But it's easier said than done.
Okay. I think this is a good segue actually into my second question.
Okay.
Okay. So you kind of mentioned some aspects of this, but 2020, I would say in general, is a crazy year. So this is going to be a doomsday question.
Okay.
Should I buy gold? Since money is all in our head, should I bury that gold? What needs to happen for all the banks in the U.S. to fail? Because I feel like there's a scenario. What should I be looking
out for? So that's a good question. So I'm not going to go on here and give people investment advice, because that's not what I can do, nor can I even do that for compliance, because that's not part of it. But I could speak about how a doomsday scenario would work.
Yes.
Like, let's say things hit the fan and this doesn't get better, and all of a sudden a new strain comes out that's more contagious and more deadly, and the vaccines we've developed don't...
Turn us into zombies?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's movies that talk about this that we think are ridiculous, that we're not that far removed from at this point. So let's say that happens, and you're basically roaming the streets with a gun and your dog fighting for food, right? So in that scenario, is gold any better for you than paper money?
I don't know, but people say to buy gold. Why do they say to buy gold?
So if gold is valuable if our economy collapses, but we still have a society, right? But if there's no more society and we're in like an apocalyptic world, then you should be hoarding water, right? And toilet paper. So it depends on what you're worried about. I would say the historical rate of return for like a commodity like gold and silver and copper and stuff like that is not as good as the market. Let's just be honest. It's not. The US stock market over, you know, 50, 100 years will return more money than gold and silver. A big reason why is that if you bought like a little gold coin and put it in your safety deposit box and left it there and came back 10 years later, there's not going to be tiny little gold coin shavings or little gold coin
babies,
right? But that's what investing in the market does, because even if your stock or investment didn't grow a lot, it pays you the earnings in dividends, and you get that over time. And that's where a lot of the growth and investment returns come from. So you're really relying on that commodity to become more scarce and more valuable over time. And usually it doesn't keep up with the market. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing to have a part of your portfolio. You know, if you wanted to have 5 or 10% in gold or silver and stuff in case that situation happens, I think that's a great idea. But I wouldn't put everything in it, because it's probably not going to work out for you in the long run.
Well, I'm also talking about a situation where, not necessarily zombie apocalypse, where like everyone's just worried about survival, But the banks of America failed.
Yeah.
Like, our country failed.
So
Other countries are fine.
Right. So if our country failed and our economy collapsed on itself and we were in ruins, I think that would then lead to an apocalyptic society. I don't anticipate any way where only that would happen with us in America. The rest of the world would be fine and everyone would go on living their lives. I see it where if it got that bad, Sophia, it would descend into like chaos where then gold wouldn't mean anything. Now, that's not saying that couldn't happen, but yes, you're right. Technically, if that happened and the U.S. economy collapsed and the market was worthless anymore, but we still were living in a civilized society, then yes, it would be much better to have gold because that would be worth something, right? Other countries would pay you money and you'd have the gold. I just don't see that all happening without like, you know, being in a bomb shelter with canned foods for years.
Are you saying that because U.S. economy is so ingrained in other countries? Because
yes.
Other countries have gone through it.
Yes.
And their currencies are worth
less. Exactly. In the future, you know, in hundreds of years from now, it could happen if we're not a superpower anymore. And, you know, that could happen. But it would happen very gradually. And it wouldn't happen in our lifetime, you know. So yes, that's exactly right. It's too many things are tied to us, militarily, for one,
yeah,
and the global economy as well. You know, it would be pretty. I mean, if Europe collapsed, it would have a pretty detrimental effect too. So it's not like, you know, we're the only country propping the world up. You know, same with Great Britain. You know, there's plenty of countries too that if they collapsed would have serious negative effects on the world, but the U.S. would be the most. So yeah, hoard that 5 or 10% gold for a rainy day in case that happens and you got to bribe the robots. I don't know. But yeah, for me, I would be more worried about if that happens, fending for my life than I would be about having gold to trade. I'd rather have water and toilet paper and food. That would be more valuable. So yeah.
So build a bunker. And then put the gold in the bunker.
Yes, with food Those and toilet areas. Paper. With food oh, yes. and toilet paper and water. Yeah,
yes.
And okay. Some type of toilet too. Yeah, you got to think about all these things. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, well, this is going to take me a few years.
Yeah, I hope so.
You need to start working on it.
or make some friends that that have one already.
Yeah, I guess that's what I should start asking people instead of, like,
yeah.
Niceties.
So I'm Sophia. Do you have a bomb shelter?
Yes.
Can we be friends?
I don't take up a lot of room. I have some room.
Yeah, my dog's very small.
He's very small, but he is barky. Yeah. Are you okay with that?
All right. I like the questions. These are different.
Okay, next ones are going to be turning more
okay.
to me.
So let's perfect. I like personal questions. Let's do question
Great.
Three then.
Question three. So I mentioned in my intro that I got engaged.
Yes.
We're planning the wedding. It's going to happen eventually when hopefully the world is more normal. What are the pros, cons, / things to consider when deciding about combining finances?
That is a good question. And I'm going through this now too. We were supposed to be married last year, but had to postpone to later this year because of COVID. I'd say that combining finances is one of those things that in theory, you have to do it, right? You have to have a joint bank account. You have to have a joint credit card statement. You should maybe have a joint investment account and get everything together. But in reality, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. And there's a good chance that one person is making more than the other or saving more than the other, and those get split evenly. So you do have to make sure you're protected a little bit. So I recommend people to still open up those accounts, but they don't necessarily start like flooding in all the assets. So I tell people start with the joint credit card. That's a good thing to start with. And start with a joint bank account and start with a conversation. it really, you need to have a conversation. I tell people and couples, you'd be surprised, besides like infidelity, like money and finances is one of the top three reasons why couples don't make it. Someone hides an investment account, you know, somewhere else and uses it on them. One person is spending all the money, one person's making it, right? I mean, there's all these, money is always a huge issue with couples. So you always want to have a conversation. Have a conversation about what your goals are with money, right? Maybe make a budget. If you've done one on your own, make a budget with your fiance. It doesn't have to be exact, but make a, you know, rough budget and see how that goes and make, have an open dialogue. I think that's really important. It'll help prevent some issues in the future. So then when you open and combine finances, one, there shouldn't be any huge surprises, which is always an issue. And two, it helps you get a little bit more on the same page and build some trust a lot. Because if you're going to be married together, I mean, this is something you're planning to do for the rest of your life. It's something I assume you're taking very seriously. So you should also be taking the same amount of seriousness with your money and finances as well. There's nothing wrong with having your own bank account and having your own money somewhere else. But I would be disclosing that as well. Because like if I was making more money than my spouse and I was looking at our accounts and they were spending all this stuff on things for them, I'd be, you know, that might rub me the wrong way, especially if you didn't have a conversation. So hopefully that helps. I'm curious, what have your thoughts been on this?
Well, I mean, I've lived my whole life with my own bank account.
Uh-huh.
So like, I almost don't even see the benefit of having a combined one.
Well, one, it should be bigger. So if you're both putting money into it, mm-hmm. and you're living together, and also, once again, this helps if you have kids, right? And you're spending money on the same things, it should be very easy to take it from the same pool, right? You got to go out and buy groceries. You know, they're not for, you know, a lot of times you're buying stuff for the collective you, for you, mm-hmm. your husband, your significant other, your kid, your dog, everything you share together, right? So you should have money set up for that both of you are putting into. Doesn't mean you have to put all of it in, but with banks, with, you know, having money, the more money you have in an account, you get some benefits. Same with investing, all that stuff helps. You know, credit helps too. If you have a joint credit card, it can help it build up scores. You spend more money, you get more rewards and points too. So there's some benefits as well. And then, like I said, the trust thing is a big part of it, to be honest. But you always, I tell people, start small. Don't jump right in and kind of mingle everything right away. It's a slow process that might take a few years and obviously changes when you have a kid. But there's a lot of benefits to it for both personally and financially.
So, I mean, maybe you're going to say this depends on the couple. But what percent would you say, or what range do you say, of your income should go to your own personal account versus a shared account?
Well, yeah, it does depend. One of it depends on if you have kids, right? So if you have kids.
So I don't have kids.
Right, yes. So you don't have kids.
So for me.
Right, so it's just you. So that would depend on a conversation. You know, you should talk to your fiance and go over, well, what are our shared goals together? Do we want to buy a house in the future? Do we want to go on a vacation in a few years? Are there things that we want to do together that we know are going to be us? And then you could start together saving towards that goal. That would be where to start. That wouldn't be all your income. That would be, you know, a portion of your savings. It could be a few hundred bucks a month based on.
Well, okay. Yeah. So what if, I think it's pretty common for one person to make more.
Yeah.
A lot more, a little more, whatever. Would you say like everyone puts in $1,000 a month, or everyone puts in 50% a month?
Yeah,
different for each person.
You got to do percentages. I wouldn't get too caught up. Listen, it's one person's gonna make, even if both people are making a good amount of money, one person's always gonna make more mm-hmm. than the other. That's true for almost everyone. And I wouldn't get too caught up in, well, you know, I put in $1,000 a month and you put in $500, so I get, you know, 2/3 of the say of this. That would be I wouldn't do that. I mean, that's where I say there has to be trust. I would say you also have to understand that you're trusting that you're going to be with this person and they're going to be using the money on stuff for us. So that's why you have to have a conversation and why you also don't put everything into start. But, you know, if you have a, if you have goals and stuff you want to save for, you know, I would put it in it. Then maybe if you make more than your significant other and it's going for a vacation, you know, you should get to decide where you go, something like that, you know, just do it like that. But no, there's, I wouldn't get too granular. I wouldn't get like keep track of who puts what in, because that also creates problems. You know, you're just gonna have to accept the fact that if you make more, you might put more in, and you know, you should have no problem because it's the person you want to be with, right? And it should make you happy. And if it doesn't, I would say maybe that's a, I'm not the right person to speak to, but maybe you should talk to someone else about that. But from a financial point of view,
you're getting into some therapy over here.
Yeah, but I do that, by the way. I feel like when I, especially when I work with couples, there is more therapist and that in my job than anything else, especially when they have kids. And especially when there's one working spouse and one who's not. And you never make it a competition, and you never keep track of that stuff, and you have an open dialogue. And, you know, just knowing that that the money is going towards us. And when you sign up for marriage, right, it's us. Mm-hmm. You have to give up a lot of things too. So have your own account and have stuff for you and buy the stuff you want. And, you know, also have something for the two of you as well. And like I said, start small. I wouldn't start with $1,000 a month. That's probably too much unless you're making a huge amount. You know, each start with a few hundred bucks and then slowly build up on that.
Okay. I guess it's a respectable answer.
You know, you don't seem too impressed with that.
Well, I mean, any answer that's like, you have to have a conversation isn't a real answer. It's more of a guidance, which obviously,
yeah,
that's true, but it's like,
I could be there for you when you have the conversation. I'm happy to. You're but most be the people, mediator? Yes. Most people, I do that for some people, to be honest, but most
really?
People, yeah, but I don't like to force myself in. I think you'd be good to do it in yourself, but some people need a mediator, especially when one has such vast differences in spending habits and earnings than the other, and they feel like they need a mediator, and it's not a bad thing, but that's why I'm saying I'm happy to be the mediator for you if you need someone like that, but usually it's best you two are going to know each other better than I do. That's why it's usually good to have your own conversation as well.
Yeah, and I don't think this is a topic that I haven't thought about too much in the past because we're so different. I think it's the opposite. Our spending is very similar and we both save a lot. So
that's
I'm
good.
Like, doesn't make sense if it's two accounts, one account, three accounts, whatever.
A lot of it, once again, is psychological and just good for the relationship. It's not necessarily a money thing, but they do weirdly go hand in hand. I tell you, it is better for the relationship when you have that cohesion financially, because I'm sure a relationship therapist should tell you to have cohesion with the rest of your relationship. So money also applies. It's just trickier because it's a little out of everyone's element and it's personal, right? I don't want to get there, but similar. I would apply the similar concepts to the rest of your relationship as you would for this, to be honest. You just might need someone to give you some actual money advice if that's out of your element. That's all.
Okay. I like that you're bringing therapy into this.
Yeah. Perfect.
It's making me calm. Okay. My next question.
Yeah.
So stop me if you heard this one before, but there was an article online that was circulating maybe like 3 years ago now, that was like, by the time you're 30, you need to save a year's worth of your income.
Right. I've seen
that.
Do
you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that article has been living rent-free in my mind. What does that include? Does that include just your 401k? Does it include your liquid savings? Does it include the gold that you bought in your bunker?
Yeah.
Like, is there any meat to it?
Yeah. So there is. And there's also some validity and some not to that. It's a guideline. So if you're making $100,000 a year and you're 30 and they say you should have $100,000 and you have 90, you're not screwed. You're not right. You're fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Because the younger you are, those are not huge numbers you need to have. But it does include your 401k. It would include the value of gold, right? Because technically, if you had gold, if you had $10,000 of gold buried in the backyard, you could go get that, dig it up, go to a place, wherever, that buys gold and get that money right away, right? I wouldn't include a value of your home in it. That would be one thing I wouldn't include, because unless you have like multiple homes and you could sell one, it's not like you're just going to be like, okay, I'm going to sell my home and get the money. Well, okay, first of all, where are you going to live? And second of all, it doesn't work like that. You have to like find someone to buy it. It's a long process. It's not immediately liquid. But otherwise, cash in your bank, investments, your 401k, you know, anything that might be valuable. Maybe you have some stuff that, I mean, if you have something valuable that you're never going to sell, then that doesn't count. But if you have like a, you know, some nice car or some piece of art that you think you could sell that's worth something, yeah, I would throw that in. But it is just a guide, because if you make $150,000 at 30 versus $50,000, it's going to say, if both of them have $50,000 saved up, one of them is going to be doing right on goal and the other one's going to be really behind. So that doesn't necessarily apply to everyone, because, well, also where do you live, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to adjust it for, are you in a place that has a high cost of living with higher income? You know, if you're making $50,000 and you have $50,000 saved up, but you live in downtown Chicago, you know, that might not be great, because things are expensive and the wages are higher. If you make $100,000 and you have $50,000 saved up and you're in, you know, rural Montana where things are cheaper, I'm going to say that person's a lot better off and is a lot closer to their goal. With you being that young, I wouldn't get too concerned about that. Once you hit the 50s and 60s, then those numbers become a lot more important. And then those numbers become a lot more real and visible. Right now, it's just something eating in the back of your mind. I would use it as motivation, but don't beat yourself up if you're not there, okay? Because almost very few people in their 20s and 30s have investable assets and of what they're making as a salary, to be fair, unless you're making very little money, or unless you're making a crap load of money, right, and then are unemployed. It's, you know, it's just most of the people are going to be behind that goal, to be honest, especially young age, because they're still paying for debt. They're still living their 20 life, which isn't about saving for retirement. It's about having fun and
I can't believe you would say that.
Well, I'm not that person. I've saved very well. I'm a great client of myself. But yeah, I have probably 2 times my income, but I'm a really good client. I'm a really good saver, and I'm a professional, and I've been doing this for a while. But most people are not like that. They're living their life, and they should be. You know, I don't want you to sacrifice too much of now so you could have 1 times your salary saved, so then you have to sit at home and do nothing, right? That's bad advice. You got to have fun. It's a balance, right? And then make sure that you just are putting enough away so you can get to that goal.
Okay. What I got from that is move to Montana.
Well, know what you want and know...
Montana.
Well... And there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually a very beautiful state. I drove through there from Chicago when I moved here to Seattle, and it was really nice. But know that if you have lofty goals and want to live a lavish lifestyle, then you better have more saved up than if you're simple and if you don't need as much. And if you don't need a lot of lavish things and your lifestyle could be more basic, then adjust that. You know, maybe it's half a year salary at 30 as opposed to a few years. Right? It just all depends on your lifestyle. That's why I don't like those. You can't get too much specific advice on the internet, because it's not meant for you. It's meant for the 100 millions of people who are like you, who mm-hmm. have your same age and demographic and income, but everyone's different. So it really doesn't apply to you as much as you think, just so you know.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Where were you 3 years ago when I was panicking about this, Ross?
I was here.
Okay, that's what I mean.
I'm always here for free advice.
Okay, I are we at our last question?
We are at question number 5. Let's do it. Yeah.
Here we go. So, over the past few years, my New Year's resolution has pretty consistently been to be more green. I've heard of the term green investing, green investment. What does that mean?
I'm really glad you asked that because I've been waiting to talk about it on this forever.
Oh.
So, green investing, or as we call in the industry, socially responsible investing, has really picked up popularity in the last 5 or 10 years. So it used to mean something very different than it means now. So I'll tell you what it used to mean. It used to mean, Ross, I don't really want to have money in companies that, you know, sell tobacco, or I'm against, you know, firearms, I don't want to have that, or I'm very religious, I have to have these certain types of companies that follow these religious codes. And they would just pick those companies and that's it. So you really wouldn't be actively investing in socially responsible stuff. You would just be excluding things that you didn't necessarily want to invest in. It's different now. Now they're actually going out of their way to find companies that are engaging in causes and engaging in, you know, women's leadership funds are popular, where you invest in funds and companies that have women either on the board, women who are being paid equally, women who have a direct say in the leadership of the company. You're investing in companies that are actually proactively finding ways to clean the environment, to have, you know, cleaner sources of fuel. You're investing in companies that maybe don't have a lot of involvement in other countries that might be, you know, exploiting people for the diamond mines, or just, you know, various other stuff like that, right? So it's much more active and they have to follow these rules. And as a society, we've also moved to do business with companies that we morally agree with, right? Whatever those morals may be. A lot of people aren't going to go to this company or that company or support this company or that because of whatever their stances are, right? And as a result, that affects the dollar line. Some companies that might not be doing things as morally as others, you're going to see that on the bottom line when younger people boycott eating there or buying their clothes or whatever's going on. And as a result, you've actually seen a lot of socially responsible investments and funds do slightly better in the last few years than their regular counterparts. It's too small of a sample size. It's only been a few years, so I don't know if that's a trend or just a blip or, you know, just a weird coincidence. But I do know that this is a very important trend, and I don't think this is going away. And I think it's important that you should get to shop at wherever you want and do business with whoever you want. You should also feel the same way with investing, right? You shouldn't feel like you have to invest in a cause you don't believe in to make money. I believe that, and I think a lot of people believe that now. The problem is those don't exist in 401ks, right? That there's no socially responsible funds in 401ks. You have to do it on your own. You have to do research or work with, you know, a professional like myself to find those funds and do it. And it takes money, right? You have to have some money to do it. So unfortunately, socially responsible investing isn't feasible for everyone, but I think it will be. And I think it's very important. And I think there's gonna be a lot more options out there in the future. And I think it's very possible that those funds and those investments might do better than their counterparts in going forward.
Do they have to have some sort of like certificate that this company is blah, blah?
Yeah, there's some law or rule. I wish I could remember it now. That would have been the one time where the question beforehand, I could have looked that up for you. So whoever's listening to this, look that up. But there's a rule. There's like a 5% rule, but you can't have more than 5% in something, something, something. I just don't know exactly. But yes, there are. There are rules and regulations to be considered a socially responsible fund. And like I said, some of them are more active and some of them are more passive as well. So there's a lot more options out there. And they're at larger companies too, which is interesting. You could read about the fund. You know, I have clients who we have climate change funds. You know, we have carbon free emission funds. They did very well in 2020. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. The funds did very well. So because of the world's also going in that way, right? I mean, we're looking at different types of energy. We're always progressing and moving forward, and usually that's good for those types of funds. So yeah, I would say if you're passionate about that, my big takeaway from this is it's very possible to do. It's very possible to do right now, and it's very possible to do without sacrificing investment returns. People used to think I could be socially responsible, but I won't earn as much money. And I have to dispel the myth that that's not true anymore. It might take some time and research, or you might have to work with, you know, a professional on this. But if that's something you feel passionate about, you shouldn't have to settle for investments and funds that maybe don't fit your moral compass, to be honest. And I think you should be active in that if that's something you're passionate about.
So how much effort is it to find these funds and companies?
Well, it's if you're good at investing and you're a DIYer and you do this already on your own, like not the 401k, but like if you have some investment accounts on your own and you've done it, and you're passionate about it, it's not that much more difficult. But for most people who are just like, I'm in my 401k and I know a little bit, and this isn't something I'm passionate about, you have to work with someone like me. And the reason why is this has to be really personally tailored to you, right? You can't just call a 1-800 number and say, I want to be socially responsible. And then they'll just give you some stuff that may or may not be aligned to you. You have to say, Ross, I'm passionate about, you know, this specific cause, and I want to be right. And that's why. So a lot of it is work with a professional, tell them exactly what your causes are and where you want to be. And then that person could find those funds based on you. There might not be a million options out there, but it requires a little bit more research, a little bit more give and take, and a little bit more personal interaction to get there, especially if you don't know what you should be filtering through, because you know, you're not a professional. You have a job, you do other things. So that's why it's probably better to work with someone like me for that specific space, because they're not all equal. Socially responsible investing is not all the same. It's very different.
That's actually really interesting.
Thank you.
I had no idea about any of this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great wave that we're going to. I was almost going to call this the green seat or the green zone, but green, I was going to think people would think I was talking about the environment instead of money, green, the color money, but now I'm talking about both. So maybe this is the green episode of the money seat. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I've been waiting for someone to ask me because I'm so excited about this stuff. And I really hope I could find more people who are as excited as me so I can help them. Because I've only had one person who's ever really come to me and been active about this.
That's because people don't know.
Because people don't know, exactly. So I'm hoping after this episode, people are going to flock to socially responsible investing. I think it's good for everyone. The more money that goes into these, the more the companies feel like they're on the right cause.
And the more the market changes.
Right, and the more the market changes, exactly. Because usually that's where businesses make their change, right? All right. A lot of stuff they do is for PR, but if they're suffering financially, that's when they might change their goal. I mean, let's just be honest. Money drives almost everything. So if you see that happen, that could really bring on some real change as well, especially as younger people become more involved in the market and they have they have more about causes, right? Everyone, they don't just buy this shirt or this item of clothing or this food. They have a story behind it, right? Everyone, so why not have that with investing as well? And if you're passionate about it, you should do it. So, yeah.
Cool.
Oh, that was it.
Those are my five.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Sophia.
How do you grade me and my questions?
I think they were great questions. I think hopefully people listen to the podcast. That's a whole other thing. I got to get listeners. But if we do get listeners, I think they'll be intrigued by this. Definitely talk about things that, like you said, you didn't even know before. That was my goal of this, is to bring awareness and educate people who weren't aware of a lot of this before. Because if you have this question, there's a good chance thousands and millions of people listening are also going to have the same question as well. That's very common. So, man, thanks for joining me, Sophia, on the money seat. Thanks for taking your time. I know this is a little later in the day, and hopefully you had a good time. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And we'll see you for another episode of The Money Seat.
Thanks, Ross.
Bye. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.